Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms. It's Sunday, March 29th, 2015, and welcome to episode 97 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. If you've ever punched a notch into the side of a floppy disk to magically double its capacity, then this is the podcast for you. Our roundtable is just as round, but slightly smaller than usual. But I am joined by a couple of the usual guests, of course. And today, from basically the other side of the world than me, we have Jack. How you doing, Jack?
I'm pretty good today.
And also, on this side of the planet, so it's two for one against Jack, we've got Paul. Hello, Paul.
Hello, all.
No, Paul, not all.
Yeah, right.
And my name is Carrington. I get to play host, and so that means I get to select the host topic of the week, and I am entitling this topic, Teaching Old Data New Tricks. Here's something that I've been thinking about a bit the last couple of weeks. I'm going to throw it out to you guys and have a little bit of a discussion, and the question is this: what can, or even really what should you do with the data, the stuff you find on any vintage or retro computers that you pick up? You go on eBay, you buy yourself a Mac SE 30, it's got a hard drive. Maybe it's full of somebody's old schoolwork. Or you pick up a computer, it comes with a box of floppy disks, and it has a whole bunch of data on there. Maybe it's got essays, or it's got poems, or it's got some programs people were working on. Maybe you pick up a computer, it's got a bunch of photographs on it from somebody's wedding. Do you look for the stuff? Do you save it? Do you try to track down the person who had it? Do you simply erase everything sight unseen? Do you throw it on the net and try to shame people? I don't know how you guys roll. I would be interested in finding out. So, Jack, why don't we start with you? What do you do in these sorts of situations?
Kill it with fire. No.
A general policy.
My first thought, honestly, was archive.org, right? I know that like a lot of stuff is getting tossed up there, you know, people's collections of this, that, and the other thing. But then the other thing that occurred to me is like, well, what if this is, you know, it's somebody's private stuff. And well, actually, my first thing would be to probably say, okay, let's look through this, see if we can find a name, figure out who this is, see if it's, you know, if we can find this person and contact them. And otherwise, if not, maybe just toss it up somewhere. But then it could be something that is private and that, like, even though I can't recognize the person, that somehow you put it up somewhere on archive.org or someplace, it ends up getting crawled through and archived and searchable. And suddenly someone else does recognize this. Oh, crap, it's talking with this and that. You know, you never know what something that seems innocuous to me could be not that innocuous to someone else. And the other thing that occurred to me was that there were stories about the people bought old office equipment from Atari, say, and that they found on the hard drives of these computers, they found source code or compiled binaries for games for various platforms that were unreleased. And some of those things have ended up on cartridges that people have just sort of half commercially produced. And that's something that is probably not super legal. And it can seem, you know, if a lot of time has gone by, it can kind of seem like, well, whatever, the thing is old. Then whereas if it was brand new, if you bought in good faith a hard drive at a flea market today, and it turned out to have the source code to Microsoft Office on it, then you would know, okay, this, I probably shouldn't have this. I can't use this in any way legally. And as things get older, it feels kind of more and more fuzzy, but I have no idea. Since I am not a lawyer, I have no idea like where do you draw the line on what is actually usable or not of some old data that you find.
Very good points. Paul, are you a lawyer?
I am not a lawyer.
Oh.
But
well, what can you contribute anyway?
Yeah, this definitely comes up, and I know I have the, you know, kind of hope sometimes that I'll wind up with a hard drive that has, you know, early versions of a internal Apple driver or something like that on it. And I have, through a couple of circuitous routes, gotten some things that are sort of like that. And I think, you know, sort of internal stuff like that may be, that's a little better. You know, it's a little safer to kind of put out to the world, I think. But when we are talking about, you know, like dad's, whatever they are, like word perfect files or something, you know, whereas heartfelt letters to the wife that's about to divorce him and that sort of thing. You know, it does sort of seem like that doesn't really belong on archive.org. But of course, the problem is that that puts a big bottleneck in, because if you can't just dump the stuff on archive.org if you want to try to keep that from happening. You have to actually look at it all. It's not always the case that you know where they came from. I mean, you know, it's sometimes these things have either gone through a couple of owners, or, you know, this is like someone down the street died. This was in their basement, you know. Nobody knows anybody. So, yeah, I don't know. I have myself, like, people that I got discs from that I knew about, I would package them up and send them back, you know, maybe. The things that are easily extracted into text files, I would send them. Of course, even that's a little weird, because I've read them. It seems like it would be a shame to completely just say, you know, I guess I'm willing to put myself in a kind of like an authority arbitrator kind of role and say, I will look at this and I will see if what should happen to this. And, you know, rather than just say, this looks like a personal document disk, I will delete it. And actually, that also reminds me of something that's even somewhat unrelated, which is that the labels often bear little resemblance to what's actually on the disk. So the labels give you a good starting point, but there's been a number of sort of things like commercial software disks I've been interested in getting, you know, copies of, and turns out, you know, somebody initialized it and wrote three, you know, modified versions of Lemonade Stand onto it or something. So it's tricky. I mean, there's no good answer, but it's tricky. Have you come across this yourself?
I have on occasion, but not with any computers that I've purchased off eBay or that sort of thing. But I have occasionally picked up things from yard sales or garage sales, and there'll be just a box of floppy disks. And when you go through them, it's mostly pirated copies of games. And then occasionally it's somebody's letters, or it's some schoolwork or something like that. In those times, I have always gone back to the place I picked up the yard sale from and said, hey, these discs actually just had, you know, people's date on it. It looks like there's an essay, and I've never come across any photos or anything like that, because I'm generally dealing with computers old enough they wouldn't have kept photos on them. But there'll be some schoolwork or programs people have written in BASIC, and, you know, who am I to judge what might be valuable to somebody? So I've brought those back. In each time, the person has said, oh, thanks, and taken them back. But I can kind of see in their eyes, they're thinking, but I gave you the computer. What am I doing with these disks now? These are useless to me. But that is the extent that I have offered help. I just say, here's disks. Trust me, there's stuff on it. What has happened from there, I don't know. Like, I only go to so much effort to help people. I got a rep to protect. So that kind of thing's come up. Now, let's look at the flip side of this. What about you guys? What do you do with your old storage media when you're getting rid of things? How do you stop you from becoming the person that I show up on your door handing you back your floppies 15 years from now? Jack, what do you do with your old data?
It's a good question. I think since I moved away from using floppies for any of my own stuff at all, I think that at this point, I just kind of have been shuffling things from hard drive to hard drive, from laptop to laptop. And I don't think that any of the hard drives that I've actually had any of my stuff on in the past 10 or 15 years have ever left my house. They're just kind of piled up in a box somewhere. So, which doesn't really solve the problem. It's pushing the problem off into a distant future when someone will pick this up and say, what is this? And then they'll find a way to plug it in and say, oh God, what is this really? But I think, like, in the past, I definitely had floppies from when I was doing Atari 8-bit stuff in the 80s, and then, you know, Atari ST and Amiga stuff that, like, I think I just sort of what did I do? Like, I remember when I got rid of my Atari 8-bit stuff, like, I found a buyer and I had a friend who could arrange a delivery to, you know, have like UPS come pick it up or whatever. And I just sort of put everything in a box, right? Including all of my floppies. I just sort of, whatever. I didn't want to deal with it anymore. And a lot of that was, it was some commercial games. It was a lot of pirated games. Some of it was stuff that was definitely like little programs I had written that were not interesting at all to me at the time when I got rid of them, because it was like, whatever. Now I think it was sort of fun to look at what I was doing 30 years ago, just to sort of see
it. Feel the shame.
Yes, laugh at my young self. But I don't know. So, I mean, that's occurred to me at some point that, geez, I wonder if anyone ever saw that stuff and, like, what did they do with it? They probably just threw it away. I've definitely not ever had any kind of organized thoughts about, here's what I should do to make sure that my old stuff either gets properly viewed or properly trashed so no one has to worry about viewing it and wondering what to do with it.
Yeah, and what about you, Paul?
So I'm sort of in a similar situation where, you know, the hard drives that had my stuff on it, generally, I still have them, and they're also non-functional. You know, like I switched to a different hard drive because it was dying. But stuff I have now, I actually I encrypt the stuff that I probably would not want the world to see, I guess. You know, so, and in fact, I guess I ran across that quite a while ago. I'm trying to think what this was. I had made some database in the early 90s on a PC, and it was, I think it was a catalog of, I don't even know what, it was like a catalog of things I had on audio cassette or something like this. And for some reason, I don't even know why, because it wasn't particularly sensitive information, but I saved it in a zip file that had a password, and I have no idea what that password is. I've tried, you know, throughout one's history, one has kind of common passwords one uses, and I spent a while trying to do that. I downloaded a zip password cracker to try to brute force it open at one point, but it was taking too long, and that's sort of disappointing, you know, that I actually have it in some form, but I can't get to it because I lost the key. That does seem like one way you could sort of protect yourself now. It's not particularly effective on a 1 megahertz machine. You know, you don't want to spend the whole time decrypting.
Mm-hmm. For me, it was never an issue before. Back in the days of floppies and stuff, I would simply erase things. I'm sure I just ended up throwing out or passing along floppy disks that probably had things like essays and writing on them and who knows what. Once I got into the world of hard drives is when I started being a little more concerned with passing on things, because you'd have so much data, and a lot of times there'd be work data. For the longest time, I just would erase drives, like a full low-level few passes, erase them before passing things on, and then reformat them with a new operating system. The last number of years, when I get out of the sort of the retro period, anything modern, my family has a custom metal fabrication plant. And so I use the iron worker, and I literally punch holes through drives. So whenever me or my family were, you know, getting rid of computers, the hard drive is removed and large holes are punched through it. And so basically physically destroying them and say, there you go. I don't worry about encryption anymore. It has had six holes punched through the middle. And so that's, I sort of physically deal with it now. I do find it funny that I struggle all the time with making sure, you know, my backups are in place and everything's in the cloud and multiple local backups and all of that. And it seems, on the one hand, there's this frantic, you know, effort we put in to save and keep our data. And that's the data that always seems to just vanish and disappear and get lost because you didn't back it up properly. But then on the other hand, there's like, oh, whoops, all the private stuff I want is out on the internet. one hand, data seems to just want to copy itself everywhere and distribute all over the internet, unless you intended to back it up, in which case probably your backups will fail and it is gone. So maybe the best way to keep things private is to attempt to back them up. So in your case, Paul, I think encrypting something will just make it look like a juicy target someday in the future. So yeah. If you're going to lose data, don't lose encrypted data, because if anybody's going to just in the future search for stuff, we're going to search for all the juicy encrypted things, because that's where all the goodies are.
Right. Yeah, I've gotten a number of things that really do seem like, I mean, you know, so one, there's one class of things, which is kind of like, you know, private life data and stuff. And then there's just like really tedious business spreadsheets for a, you know, some business that went out of, that folded, you know, some 15 years ago or something. Those two, I sort of feel like, you know, they're sort of not of interest to anybody except someone who wants to kind of figure out what was happening in the company. But at the same time, it doesn't feel quite right to put that out there either. And you know, who knows, the payroll system may well have a whole bunch of, you know, social security numbers in it and stuff.
Mm. The dream always is that I will pick up floppy disks or something and it will have a different version of a game than has been released, or some source code or something like that. But alas, that never happens for me.
Right.
Alas. Hopefully in the future. So that is our topic. I would be very interested to hear from our listeners. What do you do with data that you get when you acquire retro tech? It's not your data, but now it's in your hands. So what do you do with it? Do you distribute it? Do you delete it? Do you try to find the original owner? Let us know. You can send us feedback at, what is our feedback email address? I think it's feedback@rcrpodcast.com. So you can send us email to that, and we will talk about you off air, and we will discuss the morality of your decisions. So let's jump ahead to the items of interest. Look, I go first. So Carrington says, that's me, you know. I'm going to throw into our show notes a link to something that just tickled my fancy. I've got a couple things this week that are sort of more retro game related, but I dig them so much and I think they'll be interesting to our listeners. And the first is this, the Magnavox Odyssey, basically first game console. It appeared on the television panel show What's My Line, with people using it, and they have to, the premise of the show is they ask questions to try to determine what is this thing. And so they're asking questions while a person is demonstrating the Magnavox Odyssey. And what's fascinating is to see the lack of vocabulary they have compared to what we have. Like, we understand the idea of using joysticks, of moving things on a screen, of basically a Pong game. But this is in the pre-Pong era, and it kind of baffles people to the notions of it, the vocabulary, the ideas of it. And I find that kind of thing really interesting. And as various media, as not just games, but movies, but novels, but whatever, as they emerge, vocabularies and notions of them, a shared way of discussing them and thinking of them emerges as well. So it's really interesting when you come across a document that exists before that vocabulary is in place. And so if you find yourself interested in old console games and such, this is a really neat look into the period just before they came out and people kind of struggling with the notions that we would find incredibly basic right now. I found it a very fascinating and entertaining little video. So it's up on YouTube and we will throw it into the show notes. Did either of you guys get a chance to watch it?
No, but so when did it air? Do you know?
Does it say? 1800s.
Okay, yeah.
I don't know.
It says the Odyssey was released in 1972.
So I think this would be 1971.
Yeah. Right. I've only watched it. I sort of like skimmed through it a bit. Didn't really listen. I just saw that they were playing kind of a Pong style game.
Well, no, the TV series ran from 1950 to 1967. So it shows you how early this has to be.
What? Actually, they kind of had an Odyssey in 1967.
The Odyssey was invented in the 1920s. It's not released before that.
This must have been an annual Christmas special or something.
Right. Yeah, in advance. It's totally fascinating. And one of the best reasons to watch it, Soupy Sales is on it. So it's got to be 70s. Soupy Sales wouldn't have been a thing in the 60s, was he? I think of him as a definitively 70s kind of guy. Am I wrong about that? I could be wrong about that. Before my time. Know. Anyway, it's fascinating.
It's interesting and it's old.
And the TV they play it on is huge.
Oh, that is beautiful.
Massive old TV. And it's just lovely. Anyway, I found the whole video fascinating to watch this. And mostly people sort of struggling with the notions and the clearly kind of faked video when they show the game. I'm like, this can't really be the game. The thing's moving. But anyway, the whole thing is very bizarre. So definitely worth a watch. So next up, Jack, what have you got for us? Something about, somebody getting hassled by what you call zombie Atari?
Yeah. So there's an indie developer named Jeff Minter who has been putting out games for, 30 years or so through his own company, Llamasoft. And he's always had these sort of quirky, kind of mind-bendy things. And as technology's gotten more advanced, he's been able to produce things that are more and more graphically intense and weird and trippy. And a lot of what he's done in the past 15 or 20 years, at least, has been spinning around circles on kind of the old Tempest video game. And that sort of began when, in the early 90s, he was on contract with Atari to make a game for their upcoming Jaguar system at that time. And so he made this game called Tempest 2000 that was a modern update of the original Tempest game, which if anyone has not seen it, the original game was a vector game where it's called, the genre is now called a tube shooter. You have a character moving around the edge of a kind of a tube. You can see, like, it's like a 3D tube you see down towards the end of, and things are coming up at you and you're shooting at them. So anyway, he made an update for this called Tempest 2000. And his latest game that he's put out for the PS Vita, I believe, is called TXK. And this is kind of a play, I guess, on the naming of Tempest 2000, which is something that's called T2K. Anyway, he's made this game, which is very much a Tempest-like game. He's not calling it Tempest, and he's not using any actual graphics from the original game or from Tempest 2000. It looks very similar. It's obviously this kind of game. And Atari is now going after him to say, hey, you need to stop selling this game on the PS Vita. And by the way, we know you have plans to release this for the PC and PS4 or whatever, and you have to not do that. So they've been sort of sending lawyers after him, or having their lawyers talk to his lawyers and tell him to stop. And he has sort of now been publicly complaining about this. And to me, it's an interesting point, because the modern games he's making, like this TXK, it is very much Tempest-like. If you play the game or see a video of the game, it's a lot like the original Tempest game, and a lot like Tempest 2000, the update that he worked on. But at the same time, there is the idea of copyright on the actual product. I mean, it's one thing if you are lifting the actual bits and bytes from something, but to me it seems like if you're making a new game that is in the spirit of an old game, to me it seems like that, like the idea of a game, the idea of how a game works, is not something that ought to be copyrightable, or I don't know. It's an interesting thing. There's been a lot of press about this, within games journalism, and I don't know if there is a clear-cut answer on who is right or wrong here. To me, I feel like Jeff Minter is pretty much right here, and I feel like the very fact that, he's this guy who's been doing this. He lives out in the countryside in Wales. I guess he makes a reasonably comfortable living, but I don't think he's gotten wealthy off of making games based on the 30-year-old vector graphics game. So anyway, it's not like he is actually... It's certainly not like he's robbing Atari or anything, but I think one of the things that Atari is into these days, since they don't actually have like developers on staff or actually produce anything, all they're doing is contracting out a few things like this. I talked about this Asteroids Outpost game that they're making a few weeks ago. Like they're trying to sort of just kind of reuse their old IP in kind of new ways, and trying to sort of latch on to what are the new games people are playing, the new ways people are playing games, and trying to convert their IP into that. And maybe they have designs on doing that with Tempest, and they feel like, well, we want to do something with Tempest, and this new game that Jeff Minter has made is too much like our old Tempest, and who knows. Anyway, it's something that I feel like it's a very interesting discussion, and I don't really know obviously where it's going to go, but
I've definitely seen a fair amount of this, sort of coming over the feeds. And it seemed pretty one-sided against Atari, the stuff that I was reading, where essentially, Atari was sort of just trying to make use of the name that they still had. And it's complicated because, I think there was some assertion, I recall there being some discussion of an assertion of, stealing code from Tempest 2000, which, of course, he wrote.
Yeah, he wrote and also wrote for, a platform 20 years ago. I'm sure he's not writing the same way for the PS Vita that he would have written it then. Like, having that source code would not have been handy.
Right. Yeah, and I think he did say something to the effect of he didn't actually use anything except, the thought processes that he used before.
But. Right.
And what's interesting is there was a port of Tempest 2000 called Tempest X that came out later for the PlayStation that was based on Tempest 2000. Like, they basically updated the source code, put out same soundtrack, same everything, and they made just a couple of changes, and therefore they didn't pay him any royalties.
Right.
And he's saying, but hold on, you're saying this new thing that uses a totally different soundtrack, totally new code, whatever, I can't use, and yet that other thing you don't owe me any royalties on because that's enough to be different, that it's like you can't have it both ways.
Right. Yeah, I think it seems like a pretty messed up situation. And you know, it seems like this is, to me, Jeff Minter, I mean, I've been following his career for a long, long time. And I feel
Stalker.
Like he's, yeah, well, I just haven't found his address in Wales yet. But it seems like he is the sort of person that you, as a technology company, you want to have on your side, because he's, you know, he's very much shown that he is capable and very willing to invest himself mentally into hardware and finding out the tricks and finding out how to make something super, super cool on the set of graphics chips that no one ever thought about.
But does Atari view themselves as a technology company anymore?
I don't know.
Yeah. If they're just going to become fitness, right?
Controls.
Yeah, exactly. So they might not see themselves that way. They don't need people like him.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that Atari maybe sees themselves as just sort of like a, I don't know, a perpetual ATM, saying, look, we've got this stuff and we can keep sort of mining coin on this.
And also, there could very well be another side to it. And I get that the internet will always rush to the defense of the small indie person against the big bad company. But honestly, I kept reading more and more and more, and I couldn't find anything that would make Atari look like anything but a bunch of D-bags in this. So
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe there could very well be another side of the story, but I have yet to find out what that is.
I guess the one thing that I sort of think about is, you know, say you take something very iconic like Pac-Man, and you make a game that looks a whole lot like Pac-Man, including that the character looks like the character of Pac-Man, but you just don't call it Pac-Man. I think that most people would agree that, well, okay, that is a Pac-Man ripoff, right? And I think that's where this kind of, they're kind of walking the line here with this one, because
I think there's a lot of precedent that you can't copyright the type of game, though. You can't make a Pac-Man game with a Pac-Man in it, but you certainly, Nintendo can't stop people from making maze games.
Right. Yeah, but I think there definitely is precedent for that. I read about something about some court cases where this has been pretty clearly decided in the past. And
yet you say you're not a lawyer.
Only in a few of the legal journals I perused have I seen this.
Well, I'm on Jeff's side on this one.
Yep.
Down with Atari. And people who make Atari podcasts should be ashamed of themselves.
For shame.
Somehow. Bit of a leap there, but who's with me? Hear that, Antic? You heard me. Anyway, good bit of news. So switching gears, let's talk Doctor Who, because I always want to talk Doctor Who. Paul, what have you got for us?
Michael's not here. We can just lay off the Star Trek for a little bit. So it's a like, I don't know, YouTube movie theater day for me, I guess. But one of the things that I came across, you know, as I was sort of looking for things to link into, was a series of ads. I'd never come across these before, for Prime Computer. So these were, I think the ads were made in 1980, and they got the actors, Tom Baker and Lala Ward, to play their characters from Doctor Who, you know, at the time. And it's basically like these, you know, little, they're clearly kind of based on the Doctor Who universe and kind of crises that come up, you know. So aliens are contacting them, demanding to know the name of this you know, like, most powerful computer, or they're gonna, you know, like, they've got, you know, someone hostage and that sort of thing. So yeah, it's a it says they were created by Australian artist Ron Waugh, but it was neat to see them. And, you know, it's just kind of funny to see the Doctor Who, my Doctor Who, of course, character doing these ads. So
my Doctor Who as well.
There are, I think there are three, maybe four ads in the sequence in the link that we'll have in the show notes, but they're pretty short, fairly amusing. Not entirely G-rated if they were aired here, actually, but anyway, so that's it.
Well, Baker and Ward were married. I think it's the only Doctor who's married a companion in real life.
Yeah, there were some allusions to that in the ads too. It's sort of clear they were doing this together.
Well, awesome. More Doctor Who, I say.
I guess actually one other thing that might be worth saying is what a Prime Computer is. And I'd also, you know, I'd actually, I'm sure I've heard the name before, but they're mini computers, I think. You know, so they're large mainframe kind of things. I don't know much about these except that I know I'm not going to collect one.
Sure you are.
Never say never.
I'll take that bet.
You can see in the videos, though, the sort of scale of them. And, you know, there's a point when he, like, turns on the tape drive and it whirs up and stuff. You know, it's they're
big. I'm going to totally have an eBay watch for one of these now and find it and see if I can entice you at some point to make a future auction pick.
I can replace part of it with a Raspberry Pi and then just move inside.
Replace everything with a Raspberry Pi nowadays. Yeah. Anyway, I like it. Anything to do with Doctor Who always pleases me, particularly when, like you, it's my Doctor. So,
Right. Hooray
for Tom Baker. I like all the modern ones too, but I'm a Baker guy from way back.
You never forget your first Doctor.
You do. You'd never forget your first Doctor. In fact, I've seen that on a T-shirt quite often at things like Fan Expo, and I agree with it.
Yeah.
So my next choice is going to stay in the realm of big computers. In this case, an IBM 1401, which was not a computer I was particularly aware of. It's big iron, big mainframe here. And it's made the news recently because it's run a program to do the Mandelbrot set, to make little fractal pictures, and does it in 12 minutes. So that's kind of awesome. And there's a great, like just a fantastic write-up with some great photos, right up of this on write2.com. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes. Including you can take a look at the actual punch cards that the code runs off of. And yes, they are punch cards, which is great. It's 16 punch cards. That's it, which I thought was remarkably few. And so I got to learn a little bit about the way the code works and how you fill out the punch cards, with the left half being the instruction and the right half being the place in memory to place it. It's also not a binary computer, which was something that was very unfamiliar to me, that it is character based. So, like it talks about how, you know, you just put 428 for the address 428. You don't use binary there because nothing in this machine is binary based. Totally bizarre, but really interesting. And so it's neat to look. It's neat that it's being used. And sure, okay, it's a Mandelbrot set and maybe not the most useful thing. And it does take 12 minutes to run, but really cool to see this being done on punch card and seeing the printout on the big green stripy paper. So the whole thing pleased me sort of visually, and I think it would please our listeners too. So we will have a link to this in the show notes.
Yeah, that's I've seen some references to this. Is there a video of it happening?
Not that I've seen. On this site, it doesn't link to one. And so the link we'll have in the show notes seems to be the one that has the most write-up, and it doesn't list to one at all. Hopefully there is one someplace, because I would love to actually see the output. Maybe they didn't take a video just because it's so slow, but they could speed it up. I want to hear the crunching of the numbers, or at least show it
Benny Hill
feeding
in
the cards.
Music.
Exactly. But it is neat to look at just even the pictures of the printout. I really like it. I like that kind of paper. So it made me pleased.
Yeah. No, that's nice. I mean, you know, no one's going to actually use this to you know, print checks or run payroll or anything anymore, but this does seem like a pretty accessible thing to actually run, and you know, it's a computationally intensive project, you know, so appropriate for the mainframe.
I agree. I agree completely. Speaking of neat printed things, that's my segue for you, Jack. Tell us about the exciting news when it comes to the book Ready Player One.
Well, Ready Player One by Ernest Cline has apparently been picked up, green-lighted, what is the term? I don't know. It's going to be made into a movie, and apparently Steven Spielberg is going to be directing this, which is very, very cool. this is being written by Zach Penn, and I had read about this a while ago. So Zach actually worked with Cline on making this this video about the Atari dump dig last year. And so now Zach Penn has been writing the script based off of the book. And this seems like a very cool thing. I am in the middle of this book, or maybe not the middle. I'm partway through this book. I've been reading it for a while now and then. And super cool book. It sort of it kind of touches all the things that we nostalgic 80s nerds like about 80s stuff. And I think it could be a really cool book. It'll be a really cool movie. It'll be interesting to see if they manage to sort of get the people who own the brand names and things that are used in the book to actually go along with having these things in the movie as well. This article that we're looking to, it does mention that it's talking about the Lego movie. Someone who was involved with that says that everyone they talked to when they were making the Lego movie, all these various brands for things, were generally pretty excited to be a part of it. So hopefully that could be the case here as well. I hope that we don't have modern zombie Atari being a spoil sport and saying, no.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was worried about. Movie.
Well, and there are so many brands that are named in this, like just a crazy, crazy number. And which is such an important part of the actual book, I think, and the story. And it'll really affect it if it's not Zork named Zork being used and that sort of thing. Like there's so many retro things, which are just a joy. Like I loved the book. But if they change all the actual brand names of software, of computers, etc., into similar things, it's going to have a totally different feel, I think.
Yeah, it seems like all these brands are pretty critical to the story, and so that kind of builds up the atmosphere and makes the setting the right sort of thing. And I'm sure they could swap out some if they had to, but hopefully they can at least get the bulk of it in place.
There's a similar thing that went on in a really, really good book called Jennifer Government by Max Berry, I think his name is, guy with two first names. So Max Berry. Mm-hmm. Max Berry. Okay, got it right. Whew, good memory. Well done, Carrington. So Jennifer Government is a fantastic book by an Australian author. Takes place in the future in which people sort of become like they take the last name of who they work for. So you might be like, you know, Bob McDonald's if you work at McDonald's. And because the government barely is anything anymore, the lead character Jennifer works for the government. That's why she's Jennifer Government. But for the most part, globalization has taken over the planet. Companies run everything. And the book takes place in a world with all the actual brand names. So you've got Coca-Cola against Pepsi, and it's about Nike. I think it was Nike. It was shoemaker. I think Nike putting out a limited run of shoes and then hiring assassins to kill anybody who buys a pair, because that will make people really think they must be the most desired shoes ever because people are being killed for them. So they put out a small number of shoes, hire assassins, kill anybody with the shoes, and then they can flood the market with those shoes at high prices because everyone will want to buy them. And it's about this Jennifer Government investigating that. So it's been tried to be made into a film for a while, but as you can imagine, Nike doesn't really like the premise very much. And so they've had a lot of trouble because it uses all these actual brand names. And again, it wouldn't be the same if it was just a pretend shoemaker. It reads so much better that it's Nike and Coke, etc., going to war against each other. I think it's the same thing with Ready Player One. There's so many actual, you know, game references and 80s pop culture references. And to not use the actual references would just kill the feel of the book. So I'm excited about the director, though, because I think Spielberg really has that 80s touch. So he's a great sensibility, I think, and can bring in the big budget and also maybe bring in the big lawyers and big intent and maybe therefore get it done right. If this was done as a little indie,
right,
I think it would never be able to use the brand. So Spielberg is probably a good thing.
Yep, totally right. I'm pretty excited about this when this comes to pass.
Zach Penn, though, I don't know. I mean, he's really good now and famous now because of the whole, he does the Avengers stuff and all those things. But I know him as the guy who wrote like Inspector Gadget and Elektra. It's not like he did any PCU. Like, this is not a guy that I think of as being like, oh, he's an amazing film dude. I think he did the first, I don't know, he's done a lot of crap. So, but he's done good stuff recently, but mostly just things where you'd shudder that his hand will be on the tiller. So,
right. He wrote the story for Last Action Hero, which was a widely panned movie.
Yeah, but I actually like that.
And that's what I've heard. I've actually not ever seen this movie.
Totally worth seeing. I don't think Schwarzenegger realized the extent to everything that it was in, but I thought it was a really nice subversive film. I actually really enjoyed Last Action Hero, but I am definitely in the minority there.
Okay.
It's interesting. I wonder, like, it must be simpler to get brands through in print. Was there, do you think anyone
Nobody reads.
Well, it could be. But you know, I wonder if he had to, if Ernie Klein had to actually talk to anybody before publishing this book about you know, video games and things like that.
Well, but he wasn't saying anything. I think it comes, if you say something negative about something, if you say, you know, this is Zork and people who played it got epilepsy and died or something, I think you can get sued for that. But if you simply say Zork existed, no one can sue you. And if you say this person plays Zork and they do a good job and therefore they win or something, I think he's using it in a way that it'd be difficult to get sued. How the Jennifer Government book ever got published, I have no idea. It's like, because there's many corporations murdering people in that. So that book's never going to be a movie.
But I wonder if there's a distinction between using the names of companies and products in a story versus showing them visually. Just like, you know, you could write a magazine article about Coke or about Nike or whatever, and that's, you know, that's not a problem.
Oh, because but there's a trademark issue once you visually do it. Yeah.
Right. That's what I wonder if that's a part of it. Like there could be trademarked imagery in, you know, company logos and names, as well as the visuals around certain products, and I don't know.
Welcome to We Are Not Lawyers Roundtable. They probably are answers to many of these things.
No.
Much more fun to just guess. It's the internet. It's all about the guessing.
It's going to be... Yeah, I am looking forward to seeing what happens with this movie. The book... I really like the book, although it's kind of clear... It's clearly sort of a frame around, you know, let's write about nostalgia. I mean, like, what kind of crazy...
I'm okay with that.
The plot is this, but...
doesn't matter. I loved it. I totally loved it. I think listeners to this podcast will have the same sort of nostalgia feel. I highly recommend it to our listeners. So there.
Okay.
Cool.
So, Paul, we throw it to you for the last bit of news. Something about an MC10 RAM.
Right. So... just recently, Chris Osborne, who goes by Fostex on the various, you know, media outlets, he on Twitter and so forth, so what he did basically was he took a it's a Radio Shack MC10, so it's a little tiny computer. It's a color computer, but like the cheap one. and he built up a kit to give it 128 gig, which is, you know, I think it starts with 4. So this is pretty impressive. And he didn't create the kit. But what the thing that I thought was kind of remarkable was basically just that he did a video. It was a Google Hangout, actually, of him just constructing it. You know, so it's an hour long or an hour 10 minutes or something like this. And he just, you know, set up a camera overhead and sat there and soldered it together in one case, I think, on the wrong side of the board. while conversing with people on the Hangout. And what I think is kind of cool about that is that if I ever wanted to do this, I would totally watch this. I must admit I did not watch every second of it because I was not doing it. But this kind of resource is actually really nice to have. And, you know, if somebody's going to I do have a couple of kits that are sort of like this, you know, like the one for the, it's like a flash kit for a pet, you know, that I have to put together, and I'd like to do that. But this is really a nice idea to kind of like, yeah, unless you feel very insecure about your soldering, but to actually just make a video so that somebody else who maybe is slightly less experienced or just wants to see where the problems might be and that kind of thing can kind of follow along. Now that we're in the age where video is easy, it's a neat thing to do. Anyway, so it's I kind of wanted to make people aware of the video, and if you are actually interested in, you know, giving your MC10 128K, this is you can see what's involved. But anyway, so that's about all I had to say about it.
I agree completely, though. I love these sorts of videos, and I agree that they are a phenomenal resource. Being able to not just read about something, but watch somebody go through the steps of doing something is just the best thing. So, I mean, I have no intention of doing this anytime soon, but just the fact that it exists and that we can link to it, I now know where to find it if I need it in the future, is great. Well done, you.
Well
finding it. You really didn't do anything but link to it, but yeah, still, right. Well done.
That counts.
Doctor, the universe is about to end.
What?
We need the orbital coordinates of 900 planets of the constellation of Castorberus in 17 seconds.
17 seconds?
16.
Constellation of Castorberus in how many seconds?
11.
Good interaction so far. 900 planets?
10.
Excellent response.
Come on, Doctor.
900 planets in how many seconds?
3.
3 seconds?
1 second, Doctor.
1 second. Well done, Prime.
Prime computer.
Not so loud.
Prime computer.
That's better.
So now we've come to the part of the show where people can buy me things. Ah, love this part of the show. Purchase, purchase, purchase for me, me, me. So being that I am the host, I get to pick the retro computing gift idea. And as I said at the very top of the show, I'm very focused this week for some reason on retro gaming type things rather than straight computer thingies. And I am selecting the Retrode 2, which is a USB game cart adapter. Now, what that means is this is a little box that has USB out, plugs into your computer, including an older computer, as long as it's got USB, and you can plug into it actual cartridges. So you would plug into it a SNES cart, or it takes a Genesis or Mega Drive carts as well. And it's a sort of a, what I like it, it's a flip on the typical way this sort of emulation goes. Because normally you'll have, say, the real Super Nintendo, and you'll use an EverDrive cart. You'll use like something like that, where it's a cartridge taking a little, taking a little like SD card that's filled with ROMs, and therefore you're playing on the real hardware, but you're playing a ripped version of the game, essentially. This is the exact opposite of this. So instead, this is a way to play with real cartridges, but on an emulated system. So why would you want to do that? Well, you'd want to do it if you wanted to enable cheats. So that would be the main reason to do it, I guess. So you play with a real cart. But a lot of times it's something, because you can use save states, you can do things, and it's instead of, it lets you get past that, say, legal hurdle, where you worry, hey, I'm going to run an emulator, and I'm just going to willy-nilly download pirated software all over the internet. And few people would say that that is legal. So here, instead, it would be, no, you have purchased the actual game, the actual cartridge, but you're just going to play it through an emulator rather than plugging into a real box. So a lot of people that want to play these games don't have room to have a bunch of real consoles hooked up to old TVs. It's difficult to hook them up nowadays. This lets you hook it up to something that will play nicely on your computer monitor, easily to get it routed back, say, to a TV through HDMI or something like that. Lets you play with, it's got actual joystick ports in the front, so you can play with real controllers on a real cartridge, but lets you play on whatever kind of monitor you want through an emulator. Very easy to build a little box in that you could use this as a console hooked up to a television, that sort of thing. A little pricey, it's $60, but neat. I like it. I wish this kind of thing existed for retro computers. I really wish I could buy an external USB 5 1/4 inch floppy disk drive that I could put in a real floppy and it would be just recognized and worked perfectly over OS 10 on a Mac. So I'm selecting this hoping that it puts that idea out there and that more of these things exist, particularly for retro computers. So that's why I'm selecting the Retrode 2, hate the name, like the product, available at DragonBox. So we will have a link to that in the show notes.
Interesting.
And now we get to the eBay auctions. More purchasing. We are not lawyers, but we clearly all want to buy lots of things. According to the show notes, it looks like I also get to go first. And what I am selecting for mine is an item from Bob Bishop's estate. In fact, I think, Paul, you were asking, you had found something on eBay recently that had popped up and was supposedly from Bob Bishop's. And we're like, well, who is this doing it or what have you? And it does seem to be the actual estate is now selling things through eBay. So I don't feel that bad linking to it. This is a copy of Dung Beetles for the Apple II, still fully sealed. This is not something that comes up very often on eBay. Still has a day and a half or so left. Currently has been bid up already to $256. So holy moly, I expect it'll go higher than that too. That reflects the fact that it's Bob's personal copy. It reflects the fact that it's still sealed and the fact that a fully boxed copy of Dung Beetles isn't something I've seen in the last few years on eBay for the Apple II. So rare game in a still sealed box from the estate of the guy who made the game. So just about as collectible as this game is ever going to get, but it'll cost you over $256 if you want to get into the bidding. I'm also going to link to a much more reasonably priced item, which is Megabug, the cartridge for the Tandy Coco. It's listed as being something for ColecoVision. It's not. It is something for the Tandy Coco. And this was, back when I had a Coco, my absolute favorite game. And it's basically a version, I think, I don't know if it came first, whether Dung Beetles came first or Megabug, but they're basically the same game. I never played Dung Beetles as a kid, but I did play Megabug, and I loved it, loved it, loved it. Hands down, the best game I played on the Tandy Coco. I adored it, and you can pick up a cartridge for $10. Much more reasonable if you want to go that way. So we will link to both of those in the show notes. So next up, we got Jack. What did you select for our readers to bid on and maybe purchase?
Well, I found something that is perhaps not too surprising coming from me. This is an Atari 8-bit system. It's an Atari 800XL with the 1050 disk drive and a 1027 printer. And that's all kind of run-of-the-mill. But what I kind of liked about this was that compared to most of these things you see, this thing looks to be in really, really, really good shape. Everything is quite bright and shiny. Like the plastic on the 800XL is barely even yellowed. It looks like it's all been well taken care of and is in good shape. And at the time that I picked this, it was really, really a steal. It's doubled since then. It's still like $46. It's got 5 days left to go. But back when it was like $20, I was like, holy crap, that's a really good price. Even at $46, it's still a pretty good price. I would say this could probably go up to $100 and still be an okay price. But if someone is still looking to get started with some Atari stuff, this is probably a pretty good, solid place to start.
It is really nice and clean. It's amazing how many retro computers are listed just in filthy condition. Like people take a picture and stick it on eBay. I'm like, are you ashamed to put that photo up? I mean, you wouldn't even wipe the dust off it. And I think, well, what kind of condition is the actual computer in if you're willing to show this photo and not be embarrassed?
Yep.
But this looks great.
Yep.
Although I prefer the original Atari 800 form factor.
Yeah, I do as well. Well, actually, I've found that quite a bit in the Atari retro circles, a lot of people actually go for the Atari 600XL, which is even the lesser version of this thing, because it's the one that has the smallest footprint, so it takes up the least space on your disk, and because those things are easily upgradable to have more RAM in them, as much RAM as an 800XL has. So that's another angle in the whole thing. But I agree with you otherwise. I like the design of the two original models the best.
I think for some reason, as I continue to see these, I am growing to like them a little bit more. I still like the original one better, but I don't hate these as much.
Yep.
I still don't like the tan TI-99/4A's though. Those are not.
Oh
good.
No, I'm with you on that. No, that's the wrong TI.
I haven't even seen that.
It's like it's sort of like the later version, same computer, but just, you know, doesn't look anywhere near as nice.
Made dull.
Oh yeah,
just
that.
They've taken away all the visual interest. Like that's instead of being that really neat looking one. No, let's make it dull and beige and ugh.
Right. Instead of having some nice black and some nice shiny, they said, "Oh, let's have some nice beige and some nice slightly other beige." Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So yeah, no, with you on that one, Paul. Oh, and speaking of Paul,
yes.
What have you got for eBay choice and or choices?
Yeah. Okay. So I will start with one thing that I saw was a VTech Laser 200 color computer, 16K RAM, printer, a cassette deck. I don't know this computer. I have looked into it a little bit since listing the auction, and it appears to be sort of related. It's a Z80 computer. It's kind of related to the TRS-80. I think it may actually even be compatible. But yet this is color, so I don't know very much about it. But this particular auction is really quite complete, and the thing looks pretty nice. It was originally, I think, a kind of like a low cost computer in the kind of, you know, Timex Sinclair mode. You know, it's possible that it costs more now than it did, but nevertheless, it seems like a pretty rare set, and it does have a lot of pieces. So it's got the main keyboard computer part. It has a branded cassette player that goes with it. The computer seems to be about as big as the cassette player, and a printer that's again about the same size, and plugs in it to a kind of like a cartridge. Yeah, I guess it's basically the regular kind of TRS-80 connector. And then a 16K RAM expansion module. So it's really quite complete. I have no nostalgia for these because I don't even think they were. I don't think they were North American. Actually, this one is located in Norway, and I have no idea what the shipping is to here. If this is the kind of thing that you do have nostalgia for, this looks like a kind of a neat set. And if it could get teleported to me, I might be interested. But yeah, have you heard of these before?
I have not.
I have not either.
I know it's on the auction. It says the the country or region of manufacture is also Norway. It's actually a Norwegian created thing.
So maybe we should we send you on a mission to find out?
I need to go on a fact-finding mission to Drammen, Norway. No problem.
Excellent.
How far away could it be?
But yeah. Anyway, it looks pretty neat. I mean, you know, it's not it doesn't stand out as being particularly uniquely stylish, but it does not look like anything else I've seen. Oh, so
got that amazing chiclet keyboard that's so fun to type on.
Yeah, but the color it's at least nicely colored. You know, like
it looks like it was eventually there was a Laser 310, kind of the upgraded replacement model. Same thing, but with a full travel keyboard.
Ah, yeah, that sounds possibly better. But
well, looks kind of the same. I don't know this computer at all. I'm wondering if it's TRS-80. I wonder if it's actually like a Cocoa compatible.
Yeah, I would have. That seems
because it's color.
Nothing. It seems to have color, and nothing prior to the Cocoa had color.
Yeah.
So.
Anyway, weird, neat. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
There were a couple of other things that I came across. So speaking of Cocos, I'll talk about that one. This was just another, it was another auction that seemed kind of interestingly complete, or maybe even, you know, super complete, too much complete. It's two Cocoa computers, Cocoa 2s actually. One that has the original box and matching serial number, and the other one, you know, looks the same except has no box and has a different serial number. The auction doesn't actually say that they're Cocoa 2s, what they are. And, you know, so it has the box and the styrofoam. It has, looks like six or seven cartridges. You know, so, oh, no, maybe actually it looks like maybe more like four because there are the boxes for some of them. But so it includes whatever, color baseball and skiing, and but also an assembler, editor assembler, and color scripts it. So, you know, it seems like it would be a pretty usable set, kind of just out of the gate if you wanted to start with one of these. Carrington, you are familiar with this one, right? You had one of these?
I did. Well, I had the older version, the original the Cocoa 1.
Ah.
So it had the worst keyboard and the little flat chiclet thing. It's the thing that made me forever hate chiclet keyboards.
Yeah.
But I really liked the Cocoa. Like, I liked the basic Cocoa, the TRS-80 basic that comes with it, the color basic, was actually a really good, fun, easy-to-use basic. I really, really liked the basic on that. And it eventually became my dedicated CompuServe machine. So I had a Cocoa, a CompuServe cartridge, and a 300 baud acoustic coupler modem. And basically, eventually, it was just dedicated to get me on CompuServe, and that's all I did with it. And running up very large bills for my parents to deal with. Every once in a while, the CompuServe bill still gets brought up. Just a few weeks ago, my sister was like, oh, yeah, like that CompuServe thing that one time. Because it was, when I first started using it, not only were you paying by the minute, there were also no local numbers for Canada to call in. So I was doing a long-distance call, paying by, like, old-fashioned long-distance minute charges, and paying CompuServe time, and, you know, spend an evening doing that. And what a surprise the parents get later on. So the ones in this auction, the Cocoa 2s, though, are super yellowed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
I wish stuff didn't yellow. It disappoints me so much. I wish things would stay shiny and new forever.
Yeah, actually, and now that you mention it, I can't quite tell if this is some of this might be a watermark or something, but no, it looks like there was an attempt made to clean one of them that didn't go so well also.
Oh. And also, one of them has some very nice, shiny, sparkly stars behind it as sort of a backdrop.
I think it's like
helps give me the nice impression that they're trying to make it look nice. They're kind of the opposite of the others. Like we say, some don't even wipe the dirt off. They're trying to make this one look like it's a little bit sparkly.
I appreciate the effort.
Yeah. Yes, well, you put it next to like, you know, sort of photograph baking bread and cookies in the background. And,
you know. This has got that cookie smell in the photo.
Yes, but I guess the only other thing, there was one that I wanted to mock. I don't know. Is that fair? Maybe.
Yes, it is.
We don't usually mock. This is an auction for a mass of wire and cables, some for Apple, computer and miscellaneous wire. And it might actually be interesting. I put it on my watch list, but it really is. It's just like a tangle of wires. One thing that I can identify is a Duodisc cable, which is actually a little bit useful. But the thing that kind of there's a couple of these things, that the seller's done listed, and they say, okay, so these items were purchased in a very clean sale. I don't know what that means, but also the way this person interprets eBay as working. So like maybe as a kind of public service message, if you're going to list something on eBay, don't do it like this, because the seller's plan seems to be, go ahead and bid, and then maybe when I have time, I'll go to my cabin and then I'll send it to you.
Yeah, it might be a couple of weeks before you can get up to the cabin. I see. Nice.
Very. Anyway.
For me, it's $22 shipping.
Yeah.
Expensive for me, it's to ship 30, a box of cable.
$32 to Sweden.
Very expensive for a small box of rat's nest of cables.
Yeah. Well, and actually, the thing that's even more annoying about this is that if you look at the other auctions, the Duodisc that the cable goes with is in a different auction. So you kind of have to buy it all and hope, he goes to the cabin sometime.
Well, I'm going to click follow this seller.
Yeah.
Let's see where this goes.
Anyway, yeah, that'll do. Though I guess I actually wanted to say, just to go back to way to the beginning of Dung Beetles, is a great game. I was wondering about the Megabug cartridge, because one of the features of the Apple II, Bob Bishop's Dung Beetles is that you're in a maze, but you're sort of there's a magnifying glass on you, so you see your part of the maze much zoomed in, and then sort of the rest of it kind of goes on in the background, and it's really I always found that sort of an impressive effect, like that this was even possible on an Apple II. I was wondering is that the same kind of thing with Megabug?
That's exactly it. Yep, that was so you're seeing that one little square that's the zoomed in bit, and that's where you're seeing everything in detail. And outside of that, you're just seeing the maze and just like dots that kind of show the rest of the maze. So the maze is huge and much larger than can fit on the screen of the computer. And I loved it. Really, yeah. Really great implementation of a maze game.
Oh, and it talks too.
I actually remember that I had this game. I loved this game.
Well, it looks like
I forgot all about it.
Magneto Bugs was the Atari version. And then there was also Tumble Bugs for the Apple II and Atari as well, other versions of the same game. Oh, okay.
I've never seen the others.
Yeah. I for me, I only knew the Megabug version. I didn't even know Dung Beetles until years later.
Hmm. Yeah, I've never seen this sold. I would have noticed if it had been sold, and I've only really been kind of watching this for maybe like 3 years or so, but this has got to be, I'm kind of concerned as to what this is going to sell for.
Oh, I think it's going to go massive, because reading about it, it speaks. So it's got the, the Bob Bishop magic happening. Mm-hmm. So when the player gets caught, it says it plays a digitized voice saying, "We gotcha."
Yeah.
It was the only voice in the game, but still the fact that it's getting voiced, not with a card or anything, just like right out of the Apple II speaker. Amazing. Oh, that guy just did some magic.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. It's going to end pretty soon. Like probably by the time people are listening to this, it will be. We will know how much it sold for.
Right. and it may shock all of us.
But I do think that this is official. Like the estate asked the seller to sell them, and given that, I definitely would want to know that it was from Bob Bishop. Mm-hmm. if I was interested in bidding on it. So,
but as a collectible then, like to get Bob Bishop's actual version still sealed, this is basically the most collectible version of this game that's ever going to come up. So if you did want one and money's no object, then this is the one to get.
Yeah.
Money is an object for me, so I'm not bidding.
Right.
Well, cool. Good choices, everyone, I say. Well done, us. Now we get to the last bit before we wrap up, see if there's anything to add. According to the show notes, it looks like I've got stuff to add. And while I talk about that, maybe we'll see if you guys have too. The first is, last episode, you guys were talking about the adventure postmortem. And I want to throw a link into the show notes. A really nice article on Wired.com, which is not a phrase I often use, but there is an actual really nice article on Wired.com called "How One Man Invented the Console Adventure Game." And it is all about what's his name? Robinette. And just about like the process behind coming up with adventure and everything's involved that. And so it makes a nice compliment. So if you're interested in adventure, the console game, it's definitely worth checking out. And also there is in New York City, happening very shortly. I think it's, let's see, starts on, oh, actually going to be, it's started now and runs through to the end of July. So lots of time to see it at, in New York City on someplace, 18 West 86th Street. But I don't know what the name of the place is, but that's what, where it is. There is an exhibit called 40 Years of Gadgets or something along those lines. And it is a retro computer exhibit with some hands-on stuff. So it's got lots of displays of vintage computers all set up and working. Lots of very nice clean copies, museum style of peripherals and that sort of thing. But there are also retro PCs set up, like things like Commodore 64s and such, set in positions where you can actually interact with them. So it's part museum, part interactive experience. So if you're keen on that, then check it out. Oh, I see. It's actually the interface experience. That's what it's called. 40 Years of Personal Computing, an exhibit going on starting this weekend and going on for the next couple of months. So if you're in New York City, you should definitely check it out.
Cool.
What about you guys? What's going on in your lives that's worth mentioning before we take off? Jack, what have you got to wrap us up with?
Oh, geez. Not too much, I'm afraid. Nothing retro interesting. I've been doing interesting stuff, but nothing that really matters here. So
then back in the box with you.
Thank you.
Paul, it's your chance to stay out of the box for 2 weeks. What have you got for us?
I have been doing some various miscellaneous things. So there's been this kind of long-running saga of me trying to get these 8-inch Bernoulli drives running. The saga continues. I did actually get a... So I have a 10 megabyte drive and a 20 megabyte drive.
Check out this guy.
There are some 20 megabyte Bernoullis that I wanted to try to read. And I finally got to the point where I now know my 10 megabyte drive works and my 20 megabyte drive doesn't. And so The project is still going on elsewhere. And someone will have something interesting to say at some point. But I found it sort of interesting actually just getting the drives working. And I was able to back up the cartridges that I have. And one thing that this actually led me to do was to install a compact flash, like an IDE compact flash adapter into a PowerMac G3, because that was serving as the SCSI host for these drives. And it's super easy. I'd never tried this before, but you can get these, so compact flash cards are basically just the same as it's an IDE, a solid state IDE drive, essentially. So there's almost no translation you have to do. To plug a compact flash card into an IDE, chain. And so you can get these little adapters for like $5 or whatever. And so I tried it and hadn't tried it before. And I now have a PowerMac G3 that just boots off of a 4 gigabyte flash drive. It was very easy. So very pleased about that, even if it is a little late in the retro computing era. But, yeah. And one other thing, which I'll, Mike and I will talk about this later in more detail, but I got an Apple III to boot off a compact flash card, like with no disk drive. This may never have been done before. Basically, all I did is plug it in. I didn't do any particular work to make it work, but I tried it and it worked, and that's great because the Apple III was up until someone tried this, it was dependent on having that one drive work. So. Anyway, that's what I've been doing.
Cool. So you're going to do talk about that in detail on Drop 3 Inches?
That's the goal. Yeah. So next time we actually manage to line up a recording time, I'll go through that and talk
that's
about
awesome.
All the stuff I destroyed in the process. But
well, it's also the kind of thing you could talk about and show off maybe at Kansas Fest.
Ah, yes.
Mm. We would welcome you if we're going to bring Atari people down this year. Then Apple III people can do their stuff too. Well, that's exciting. I like it. I have a quick question about the Bernoulli drives, though.
Mm-hmm.
See if I remember. Like, I remember zip drives being like a Bernoulli thing, but with the original Bernoulli drives and those cartridges, what was the... Like, I know the Bernoulli effect, so it was something about, like, the disk would lift up towards the head so you couldn't get a head crash or something. Wasn't that, like, the big deal about them?
Yeah, they're supposed to, and they were, I mean, first of all, they were super expensive when they were new, and they were supposed to be basically safer than hard drives for that reason, that the head's on top. So if the power cuts or anything like that, the disk falls away from the head, and so there's no chance of it just sort of gouging the media.
I thought it was something like that. I remembered it being something along the lines of, you couldn't get a head crash or, or something because of the Bernoulli effect, thus the name. But it was so long ago and wasn't something I ever had. I had zip drives, but that's kind of it. So it's kind of vague on what the point of it was. So now I remember. So it's supposed to be much more reliable, and 50% of the ones you have at the moment do not work.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The problem with the 20 megabyte drive is that somewhere on this actually very complicated, you know, drive controller board, there is a short. I don't know where it is, but I plug it in and the power supply clicks. I try a different power supply. I try swapping everything around. It's clearly somewhere something is shorted, and there's no way I can do that. That's beyond me, or at least beyond me soon. So I don't know. But the cartridges, I think they actually were relatively reliable. It's just that the drives weren't sold for very long because fairly quickly they moved on to the like the zip technology, and that's more like regular media.
Well, there you go. I'm interested to see the details though, so I'll keep my eye out for the drop 3 inches thing though, in particular, having that booted on new media. That's very exciting.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, that brings us to the end of another RCR. Oh, I will miss us for the next 2 weeks. But in the meantime, you can find all the shows, everything we just talked about, babbled about, etc., is available on our website, which is rcrpodcast.com. You can talk about us in the forums. The link to those forums at rcrpodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter. We are just at rcrpodcast. You can send us email, which is feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are proud, yes, hand on heart, proud member of the Throwback Network. Please review us on iTunes, because if you do, an angel gets its wings and we get more listeners. Everybody wins. So I hope you've enjoyed the episode. Thank you very much for joining us for one more time of babbling about these retro computers. We will see you again in 2 weeks. And in the meantime,
Retro Compute.